So it's great to be back. And in addition to speaking on electronic discovery, I go to comic conventions and speak there. And it's been a lot of fun being able to reach out to the greater community at large and find out people really do care about the law. Last year, we spoke on the 50th anniversary of Star Trek at San Diego Comic-Con, and the panelists included California Supreme Court Justice Quaylar, a former federal judge, and a bunch of others, and over 400 people showed up, with a line out the door of another 200. So when people think about the law, people really do care about what we do. They want to understand what the law is. Because right now, we're in a golden age of geekdom. People love going to superhero movies. We have great science fiction. When you look at all the other programming that's available on streaming services such as Netflix and Hulu, there's a lot of content out there that touches people's geek side, which then gets into the issue of bring on the lawyers to protect those properties, which was the genesis of today's program on protecting fictional characters, because there's a lot there and it's historic and deep with the different things that have happened since the 1930s. So first up, let's take a look at our agenda. We'll talk about what is protected, and we'll jump into some of the classic cases that I picked for today. And then we'll end with some of the guidelines that have happened for fan films because of what happened with the Star Trek Axanar litigation in the past year. So first up, what is copyright? Well, copyright, it's the basics for all the IP lawyers out there. And I am not one. I'm just a humble e-discovery guy. But when you look at copyright, it's our protection of literary works, of films, of pictures. And when we think of comic books, movies, books, all of that's subject to copyright protection. Well, let's really understand this by looking at one of the earliest cases in this area. And, first off, you can't copyright an idea. So the gestalt of something is not something that can be copyrighted. And there are different footnotes about this throughout all of IP litigation. For example, the Wright brothers tried patenting flight so that they would own the patent on flying. That didn't work out for them. So there are issues like that that have come up. And you can't just own the copyright for, say, a superhero, which is the first case that we'll get into. So the comic industry is riddled with stories of characters created, a different company then creates a very similar character. And that happened with the creation of Superman, which was then quickly followed by the creation of Captain Marvel. So there's a reason why DC Comics now owns both characters. So let's look at the history of what happened. In June of 1938, Superman was created. Action Comics 1, it's the beginning of the superhero comic book phenomenon. In February of 1940, Wiz Comics comes out, selling at the same price as Action Comics with a very similar character known as Captain Marvel. And it's neat seeing judges and doing these cases because they go deep, which means that you had a federal judge who spent a lot of time reading comic books, and this case was out of 1950, so there was plenty of material for him to look at over 12 years of comic books coming out between these two characters. And the analysis focused on the types of stories that they had, the types of outfits the characters wore, the abilities that they had, and the stories that were told. So what happened here? The court looks at both Superman and Captain Marvel and determines Superman was definitely original, came out first in time, and jumped into the stories that were told. And this passage from the case is kind of fascinating because the concept of a benevolent Hercules by itself isn't something that could be protected. But when you take it together with all the other parts of the stories that are told, that's definitely something worthy of copyright protection. Which then brings us to what happened next. So Fawcett, the defendant in the case that created Captain Marvel conceded that their authors did know about Superman. They went to the same newsstands, they picked up the comics. They conceded that they had access to Action Comics. The following analysis gets a little fun because the truth is normally the first casualty in any lawsuit. And in this case, we had the people who worked on the comics, who wrote them and drew the pictures, actually say, yeah, we had orders to just copy Action Comics, which the editors for Fawcett took the position, no, we never said that. And there's a paragraph in the opinion dedicated to who said what in all the testimony. And the court goes, I'm not going to jump into that. We can look at all the different material that came out and focus there. And the analysis is fun because here's a federal judge talking about superheroes and acknowledged that both had the same type of athletic physique, both were clean shaven, both had black hair, both had uniforms that you would see in a circus acrobat at the time, which was a thing. We really don't really talk about people going to the circus anymore. But then focused on the differences, the colors of the costumes. Superman was blue, Captain Marvel all red. Actual text appearing in Wiz Comics was very similar to ones that appeared in Action Comics. And there's more analysis. Superman is represented as the normal, humble reporter, Clark Kent. Works for a newspaper. Takes off the regular disguise in a then phone booth and goes out and saves the day to stop tyranny. And here's one of the comics from October of 1939, and Superman's picking up a tank. Let's jump over to Wiz Comics from a similar time frame, and you have Captain Marvel punching a tank. The court noted Captain Marvel was depicted in a similar fashion, that his alter ego, Billy Baston, was a radio reporter. Also humble, and just picked apart the different similarities between the two of them and what they did with their functions. Which then brings us to the villains, which normally were mad scientists wanting to overthrow the world, do evil, and the heroes then would go out of their way to stop them. So the court breaks down the similarities between the comics, and it's wonderfully delightful to read this from 1950. Then there's this weird issue of abandonment with DC. Not getting into the extreme details of it, they had the comic that came out monthly. They also had newspaper stories coming out as well. So that would appear in the funnies. That would be three or four panels. Well, they kind of dropped the ball in having those copyrighted. And there's a complicated explanation of the contracts that they had with the newspaper publisher and how they were in privity with them and how the newspaper publisher didn't get copyright protection over those publications. And so there was an issue of abandonment that the court really didn't get further into because they actually did find actual copying in Wiz Comics of Action Comics. Now, that's where the case ends in case law. What then follows is DC did kind of win the war. And because of that, they ended up acquiring all the rights to Captain Marvel, which then they turn into a DC character and they appear in the same comics today. So it's the same publisher now. And they've done what they can to make them a little different, but they're basically very similar characters. And when you look at the history of how they came to be with the comic book boom in the 1930s throughout the 40s, it's an entertaining story. And that's one of the earliest that took place with copyright infringement and fictional characters. This one's really sad because it's the movie Hostess, who was known as Vampyra, And she was in the 1950s, and she wore the black slinky outfit and had all the different props and would host horror movies on whatever local channel that they had, and being able to be the horror movie hostess. Well, in 1981, an actress came up to her and said, "I would like to buy your act and bring back Vampyra and be and continue being a horror movie hostess." Those negotiations fell apart. And what then happened was Elvira was created instead, who also wore the black slinky outfit, had the different skull props and everything else, and started her own character. Well, a lawsuit understandably follows when something like that happens, because you had the original actress go, "You stole my act. You're pretending to be me. You're calling yourself Elvira instead of Vampyra, but it's the same act." What then follows is very interesting and tragic analysis, because Elvira wins. And why is interesting? Because the case was brought both under copyright infringement and California law on unfair competition and common law actions for right to publicity and for privacy. So the analysis turns on what is an actual representation of someone. And what Elvira did was just take all of these core elements from Vampyra. She didn't pretend to be Vampyra. She didn't pretend to be the original actress. She just took all the qualities from it and made it her own. And the court stated, that's not enough, because that would actually produce chaos if it was, because that would mean if others dressed up in a similar way, which actors can do, there could be litigation against anyone who does something similar at some point in the future. So from a public policy perspective, it would be the wrong result. Even though when you look at this and went, this is just more than having a similar motif. I mean, it heavily mirrored the original character. And it spread out over a 25-year period of time with, you know, the 1950s versus the beginning of the 1980s. But the result is one that's actually really sad. So the analysis here from, you know, this part of the court opinion, I'll read this section here. If a person merely were to wear another's clothes or emulate another's mannerisms, an action would lie under section 3444 because the likeness was being appropriated. The problem with that, this result would greatly inhibit the development of entertainment arts and the freedom of expression. So, is it an actual representation? Is it actual copying? And in this case, you know, your gut reaction might be, this is not okay. You know, there should be royalties paid. This should not have the result of somebody else coming along 25 years later, repeating the act and being successful at it and not owing the original creator anything. Fortunately, that's not the law. And it's a really sad ending because one was successful and one wasn't. Battlestar Galactica versus Star Wars is fascinating. So in 1977, on May 25th, the world changed because science fiction became immensely popular once again. When you look at the history of sci-fi movies, throughout the 50s, we had some great, amazing, creative stories. Throughout the 60s, we had some great ones as well, but they were competing with the actual space program. It's hard to compete with your sci-fi adventure when the news looks awesome, because we were putting satellites and people into space, and then when we walk on the moon, how do you top that? And so the pinnacle of that period was 2001, which is still viewed as one of the most accurate-looking space movies ever done, because the stars actually move in the background. The amount of detail that's in that has yet to be matched by anything since. So we're in this wilderness period of, we do have some great sci-fi movies that come out in the early 70s, Silent Running and a few others, but nothing really catches fire with the general population until May 25th, 1977, because everyone went gaga over Star Wars. And movie studios then realized, people like this. We can make money doing this. And others started to follow suit with different space adventures that were very similar. Well, the people who worked for George Lucas didn't mess around, and lawsuits would be filed. Well, the first was in 1978, Battlestar Galactica came out, September 17th. I was 4. A great birthday present, because who doesn't like robots? Well, the lawsuit focused on, hey, there's a lot of things that are similar here. We have bad guys in masks that don't look human. We actually have something referred to as a droid, and nothing had been referred to as a droid until Star Wars, so that was a little weird. Spaceship battles oddly look similar, and there's a reason why. Because all of these people who worked on Star Wars needed jobs after doing so. So a lot of people who did special effects went on to work on Battlestar Galactica. So, including the guy who did the same concept art. So there's a reason why things are similar. And Ralph McLaren, fascinating man, started out doing technical drawings, like how to put together a refrigerator, and eventually got into doing movies. And so his designs for Galactica spawned several things. So he created the look of the Vipers, after creating all the look of everything in Star Wars. He then created, hey, you shouldn't have the landing pods underneath the engine because just from a design perspective, that seems bad. And so that's why Galactica got the look of the pylons off the side for the landing bays. And the ships that he also designed ended up being used in the Buck Rogers TV show. So sci-fi owes that man a lot. And when you think of litigation that follows, it's like, kind of makes sense. I mean, he bailed out after a while because he thought some things were getting a little too similar. But his story is a fascinating one, and his art collection, you can buy books with it, and it's pretty amazing. But you can see why a lawsuit would take place, because, well, that's starting to look a little similar. Well, the judge who did the first round of analysis at the trial court in this case spent a lot of time watching both. And I kind of want to hang out with him. I don't know if he's still alive, but he put a lot of time and effort into analyzing both Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica. And the test that was in 1980 when this case took place was there substantial similarity between the two ideas with the two worlds that were created? And if that answer was yes, was there a substantial similarity in the expression of those ideas? And keeping in mind that the idea itself is not something that is protectable. What then follows is the application of the Crawford test. And the discussion of this is kind of interesting, because when you get into all the nuances of copyright law, it kind of gives me a headache. And the way he explained it was, okay, so a statue of a nude human being, that's one idea. If you have a statue of a horse and a painting of a nude human being, those are all separate ideas. And the painting of the nude human being is not infringing on the statue of a nude human being, which I thought, that's a really funky way of looking at it. And why did you pick nude statues? But he did, and Freud can examine him later. The analysis was impressive, because apparently he did go to, I think, Universal and like screen BSG and watched it there and took lots of notes, and also apparently spent a lot of time watching Star Wars. And he broke it down to, both stories are about good versus evil in space, but the stories are both fundamentally more than that. And he then got into the issue of they were both very different ideas. And it's fun when a court breaks down what is the meaning of Star Wars, which is exactly what this district court judge did. And I do would love to hang out with him if he's still alive. So Star Wars is pure fantasy, in the words of the court. It is a morality play. In Star Wars, the central character is Luke Skywalker, and the movie is the story of his maturation and coming of age. In the beginning, he is a rural boy following peaceful pursuits, but involved in a search for self-identity. We all have that double sunset scene, where we look off to the future figuring out, who will we be? Where are we going? Well, that was captured beautifully in Star Wars, and the judge really picked up on it. He then breaks down the different characters, which is also epic to read. And he talks about Obi-Wan Kenobi, and is, in his view, kind of like God. That his philosophy and being that high bar for Luke to aspire to. And Darth Vader, because keep in mind, this is 1980, so Empire Strikes Back hasn't come out yet. So we don't have the I am your father scene, which would have been important for his analysis. But he basically describes Vader as the devil, pure evil. And then we have the court's analysis of Han Solo. And in the words of the court, the only character in Star Wars with human, mundane traits and feelings is Han Solo, who is less important and less central than the other four. Han Solo is merely a stereotypical sidekick. Pretty sure, since most people feel that Han Solo is their spirit animal, that he was a little wrong in this, because people are still upset about Force Awakens where Han dies, because people feel something was lost. But it's just great. It's just great to see that level of analysis and some things that are just like spot on and others where fans go like, no man, that's not right. We all love Han. So the idea of Galactica is different. The court focused on the story of Commander Adama and his son Apollo, that they are trying to lead the last remnants of humanity to safety. And this passage of, it could very well be cowboys versus Indians, except that is in space garb. Battlestar Galactica is essentially a story of some nice people attempting to lead a bewildered, homeless band out of the wilderness. The thing that the court didn't get into is both do have political overtones, and they're both very different. So when you look at the Empire, you know, the fact that they do have the Imperial Japanese Navy-style hats, there are other things that are very much, they are imperialistic. It is like fighting fascism. Donald Belisario was the creator of Battlestar Galactica, who was the hawkish Reagan hawk while Carter was still president. And so in the opening episode of Battlestar Galactica, the colonial president that gets them all killed looks a lot like Jimmy Carter. Sounds a lot like Jimmy Carter with some dovish, overly detente views, and you can just see Belisario's political beliefs, because once part of the series actually does have a missile defense to shoot down ICBMs. So we had Star Wars defense systems appearing in Battlestar Galactica before Reagan was even president. So there's a lot going on between the two of them with the issues that they were exploring and the time periods that they took place in. Other fun analysis that took place was there was a fight over the casino scenes. So in Star Wars, we have the cantina scene. In Battlestar Galactica, we have the casino. And the court actually does describe both of them at great length of what do they both mean? And one's dark and dingy and just a dangerous place. The other one looks like it's straight out of Vegas. And it's when you leave the floor, you find out that you can end up getting mummified and killed. And the idea of a bar is not something that is protectable, because that could be a scene of fear, and we'll talk more about that. But he took apart the cantina versus the casino scene, which was one of the beaches that Lucasfilm wanted to fight on. Scene of fear, something that's just commonplace. You know, you can't get copyright over people playing cards. You know, the bar scene that's in anything from, say, like Casablanca or anything else, those are just prototypical scenes that you could see in everyday life. And that's not something you can get copyright protection on. So the district court's ruling was a judgment for the defendants, and it was on a partial summary judgment motion, and they said, and the court ruled that these are two totally different stories, taking them in their broadest context. Well, let's jump forward to 1983 when this goes up to the Court of Appeals, which reverses and remands back because they do find that there were similar issues in both that should not have been resolved in summary judgment, and a trial should have taken place. Because one of the opinions actually shows like the mask of Vader versus what a Cylon looked like, and there were purported issues. So, fascinating. Now, the Court of Appeals in a footnote actually broke down all the similarities at issue. And again, courts doing great legal analysis, jumping into one property versus another. And these were Lucas's arguments that the central conflict of each story is a war between the democratic and totalitarian forces. We have the young hero's father, who's been a leader of the democratic forces, and the president of the current democratic forces is the father figure. We have a lot of other things in play as well. But yeah, that's all in like footnote 4 or 5, where they list 14 different fighting points that they had over similarities between the two. And it's an interesting case to read. Now, Lucasfilms has rightfully been very protective. And they might have won this one, but one that they didn't lose, and I didn't put it in the slide deck because it's creepy in my view, is the porn cases that took place. Because companies made porn that was inspired by Star Wars. Lucas rightfully went out and sued them because, ew, no. Well, the porn films won on parody. Yeah. Don't agree with that, but they lost that fight. Which then brings us to what happened over the past year. Star Trek Axanar, the fan film that went too far. Now, fan films, for those who aren't familiar with them, are people who love a property. They write their own story, they film it, and they put it on YouTube or some other streaming service that they show, hey, this is what we did because we love this. A lot of young filmmakers do them because it's their calling card to show, this is everything that I know how to make, and I pick characters that I like to tell the story. And people have done Kickstarters to raise money to do them, and there's been some really creative, beautiful fan films based upon Star Trek, and Star Wars, and superhero movies that are absolutely beautiful. But Axanar went too far, because you had professional filmmakers saying, we're going beyond just making any ordinary fan film. We want to go back to Star Trek's core message on what we think Star Trek should be. And they raised over $1 million with their Kickstarter campaign. Paramount and CBS took notice, because this isn't some guys in their basement making something and showing off their graphic skills. They hired people who had worked on past productions. So a lawsuit follows. And Neil Carrickree, who is now at Goodwin, is one of the, in my view, one of the top IP lawyers in the country. And Neil did a great blog post breaking down what happened in this case on the Legal Geeks. And I encourage everyone to check it out, because I used a lot of Neil's analysis to put together these slides, because he did a great job of breaking it down. So, first part of the analysis is there copyright infringement? And to show that, we need the owner of a valid copyright and copying of original elements of a work. And is there a substantial similarity between the infringing work and the original? And there are two tests in the Ninth Circuit dealing with intrinsic and intrinsic similarities and in comparing the two works. So the extrinsic test has three parts to it. You have to dissect the worked into those elements, and then filter out and disregard the unprotected elements, and compare only what is protectable, and deal with anything that could be a scene affair that's just commonplace. So here's the framework for what needs to happen. So the court found there were a lot of protectable elements that were in Axnar. The story dealt with a character who was in the original series named Garth of Izar. And he's alluded to in the original series as the hero of the Four Years' War and did all these great things. And when we see him in an original series episode, he's lost his mind and he's doing bad things. So they took an original character and were trying to tell his story. And that was one way they got in trouble. The other things that can be protectable elements were all the Klingons and Vulcans, because the story focused on a war with Vulcan, or excuse me, a war with the Klingon Empire, and Vulcan is a key element of that. And they actually had one of the actors who was in Star Trek Enterprise reprising his role. So again, little things like that that get their attention. So the entire species that are depicted of Klingons and Vulcans would be protectable, which is going beyond just any character, but saying an entire race that was created for a series. And the costumes, the uniforms, all could also be protectable works of art as well. And a whole lot of other elements, planets, battles that are referred to, types of spaceships, design of spaceships, weapons that are used, saying something's a phaser or a photon torpedo, the entire mood or theme. And now, there are a bunch of people who look at this and go, mood or theme is something you can copyright? That sounds more like an idea. So the court might have overreached in some of this. There's a lot of it that absolutely that should be protectable. Characters, races, yeah, I get that. Mood? That's a bit much. So there is some criticism of the court's opinion because they do reach for the stars in a couple places. The judge also had a lot of fun because he was not shy and making Star Trek references throughout the opinion. So that's actually kind of fun. So what follows, the Axnar folks are forced to settle because they lose on the summary judgment. Paramount's pretty much victorious and they run the gambit of what happens next. Simultaneously, Paramount releases guidelines for fan films, which makes a lot of sense because if you don't want your property being depicted in a certain way, but you still want to enable fans to go out and love the fandom, help keep it alive, young filmmakers can show off what they're making, that all seems like good things for the industry as a whole. Especially when you look at the history of Star Trek, it goes off the air in 1969. There's a cartoon in 1974 and 75, but it was the fans loving it throughout the wilderness years of the 70s that were able to help keep it alive and bring it back. And so it's the fan base that's to be thanked. So you don't want to open fire on people who have loved it for decades. On the flip side, you don't want them going off the rails either. And so we have some serious guidelines that came out from Paramount. First up, duration. A fan film can't be more than 15 minutes. You can't have more than two parts. So in total, your story can't be more than 30 minutes. And since you had folks who were going out making full-blown movies that were 90 minutes long or doing entire web series that would be the length of a normal episode from 1966, like, we don't want you doing that anymore. Your stories have to be self-contained. They can't be part of a season. And so on some levels, you know, they smack down people who were doing series annually on YouTube channels. So that's big. They also have to be labeled that it's a Star Trek fan production, and they can't use anything like official in any of the promotional materials. So they really, that's paragraph one. It goes on. It has to be original content. So they can't go, hey, let's talk about the 4 years war. So anything that's been referenced in any of the series, and there are a bunch of series and a bunch of movies and a bunch of things that could be little footnotes that people might want to go off and explore, off the table. You have to come up with your own story now. So you can't do fill in the gaps. If you have people wearing uniforms, they have to be officially licensed ones. So no more bootleg costumes as well. And it actually has to be a real fan production. You can't have people who go, well, I couldn't successfully pitch my idea to Paramount to make a Star Trek movie, therefore I'm going to make it on my own dime instead. None of that. So no more real filmmakers going out and making fan films with actors from the original series. That's happened. And no more. So it has to be fans. It has to be the aspiring film students. It has to be people who just love something and they're writing the stories. Now, none of this has been tested in court. This is the guidelines that they've put out. There's more. There are limits on how much money can be raised to do a fan film. So the cap that they set was 50 grand. Because they don't want people going out and doing crowdfunding and raising $1 million to make a fan movie anymore. Because at what point are you actually competing with Paramount? That if you're able to make $1 million because you don't like what J.J. Abrams has done with the Star Trek franchise, no more. Now, granted, that does send an interesting message to Paramount and to CBS. People don't like what's coming out, and that they're making their own stuff instead for what they like to feel like the original series should be. That's a different issue. But they put price caps on this. And there are required disclaimers. So language that says this is a fan film and get into that Star Trek owns all the rights to everything, like that language, that specific language has to appear in their fan film production. And of course, they can't go out and try registering their own works for protection because that defeats the purpose of it being a fan film. They don't want people coming out to compete. This is like remarkably different from the way that Lucasfilms has handled fan films. Granted, some of this gets into pre-acquisition from Disney, but for, I think, a decade, since around 2001, 2002, Lucasfilms actually did Star Wars fan film competitions. And so one way to ensure consistency in how stories should be told and way characters should be depicted is you announce a competition and say, here are the guidelines. And you help focus all that creative energy into a way that you want and then recognize people for it. And so after the Disney acquisition, they took a year or two off. This past year, they had one. And so there were a competition and awards in 2016. I don't know if they're planning anything for 2017 that I read on online. Everything focused on last year. But that's the other way to approach these goals. So you don't have the Wild West of people making fan films in a way that the copyright holder is not happy with the way their characters are being portrayed. Or people are making two-hour movies and raising $1 million to do so. So I get both sides. And if I worked for one of the big companies, I would really be interested in vindicating that. So what lessons do we have for creators who do anything? First off, be original. If you like a comic book character, don't make a similar one to one that you like. Come up with something completely original. Same with fan films and anything else. People love these stories, but we also like creativity. And there are great lessons from that that we've seen where a property comes along and just blows everything out of the water because it's so different and people love it. Like yesterday was the 35th anniversary of the release of Blade Runner. Talk about a wild vision of the future that nobody else has matched. People still look to Ridley Scott's work of art and go like, yeah, that's the dystopian future that everybody else models dystopian futures after. Yesterday was also the 20th anniversary of Harry Potter. And you had Potterheads who have loved that character, who grew up with it, expressing how much they love it. And so you have fan creations because people love the property and they want to keep telling those stories. The other bit of advice is look at what guidelines are available. You know, Paramount put out a big one because they got into a big fight. And I actually agree with the reason they got into the fight, because Axnar made a lot of money before actually making their film. They did Prelude to Axnar, they raised $1 million, and it looked amazing. Paramount was right to go to war. Absolutely understand why. On the flip side, do you agree with the way that they're vindicating those rights? Could there be another way to handle this? So think about that, because it's an interesting issue. Because if you do control property and you want to have fan engagement, how do you achieve those goals? How do you achieve the goal of protecting what you have and not having characters appear in a way that you do not want them to appear, and engaging the fan base so people keep loving it and keep interest in it, so that way nobody loses interest in your property? So, you know, as we look towards the summer, there's the San Diego Comic-Con coming up, and that 135,000 people attend that because they love all of these properties. It's a place where they go and gather because geeks seek each other out. Same thing will happen across the nation at much smaller shows because people love this stuff. And one way that they manifest their love is with fan films or writing fan fiction or their own novellas. And so you have to balance those interests. And I don't know all the right answers. I know the things that make people feel creepy with, do we really want that? And it's a tough call for those who own the properties and the lawyers then who have to advise on how to protect those rights. So with that, this is the brand new presentation, second in a week. Any questions? Yes, sir.
How are those fan film guidelines enforced if the fans are making a film, you're following copyright, you know, they're not infringing on the copyright, but they're maybe raised 80,000 instead of the guideline that says 50,000. How are those guidelines enforced if they're not actual law?
So I listened to a podcast in the past week that Walter Koenig was on, and he played Chekhov in the original Star Trek series. And they did a fan film called Star Trek Renegades initially, pre-guidelines coming out. Post-guidelines, they were into production for one day, and these new guidelines came out. Nobody wanted to get sued. And so they changed the name to just Renegades for the follow-up one and made it less Star Trek-y. So nobody has Vulcan ears. They changed the script where they needed to. Instead of him being addressed as Admiral Chekhov, it was just the Admiral. And it was self-policing. And people going, these are the rules, now we're going to follow them. And so that's one way that this could happen, because if people really do love the property, if people follow that one example, there's going to be self-policing. That they'll go, these are the rules, and we're going to follow the rules. Now, you might get somebody go, I'm not, and let's test this in court. But when you look at what happened in the Axnar case, it doesn't bode well for them. So I think that would be my advice of, look at what happened, look what we got from it, follow the rules. So I think it's going to be a mix of self-monitoring and people just trying to do the right thing. That's supposition on my part, but that's what I think is going to happen.
Other like causes of action aside from just copyright?
That's an interesting question. It depends what they did and what they wrote. I think copyright and then everything that falls from that would be, the basis of any complaint. I don't know. Unfair competition might come in. It'd be interesting to sit down and to figure out what else could you sue somebody for. But I think copyright's obviously the big one. Yes, ma'am?
How does it work on the flip side? So let's say someone makes a fan film.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it's the Lucas Festival. Lucas sees an idea that he likes and incorporates that into a subsequent Star Wars film, is that protected because the original film was somehow housed under the creativity of Star Wars? Or?
That, arguably, they shouldn't have any expectation of that. And if they do submit it to a fan film festival, it'd be interesting to look at the guidelines, what they agreed to, because I would bet there is a paragraph in there saying that you have no rights to this if we decide to go out and use it. That would be my gut feeling if you're submitting something to a festival of some kind. But again, that's going to be super fact specific. And if an idea somebody came up with appeared in episode 8 or episode 9, I could understand being a little miffed and going like, but that was my idea. So, but that's also the nightmare that people in Hollywood deal with of, I had a friend, and she wanted to submit a script to one of the big production companies. And I looked at the contract for her and there was like the clause was, if we use your idea, we'll give you $500. And like, there was that double take of, what? Like, if you go out and make millions and I just get 500 for this? But on the flip side, it would never be made otherwise. So that's the, if they were going to make it, you know, my reaction was, let's really go after them type of thing, but let's get the foot in the door first. But yeah, it's a great, great issue. Yes, ma'am? I think, well, those were Lucas's arguments. And so that doesn't mean that the court agreed with all of them, but they listed like the 13 or 14 points. And I don't know what happened on remand because there's nothing after that in case law. So they probably settled out in some way, shape, or form. And I think with some of the, when they replayed, at least in Canada, like the first two or three Galactica episodes as a film, the casino scene was cut out. Watching Galactica today, I think they're completely different. I think they are very different, and especially if you look at 1978 Galactica versus 2005 Galactica, both mirror the political times with what we were dealing with. So I'm in the camp that I agree with the district court, because having loved both immensely, they are both very different stories. And the fact that they're in space with spaceships by itself does not make them similar. On the flip side, I get why Lucas went to war, because there were a lot of knockoffs, and it was extensive. There was a Japanese monster called Gamera that there was a movie that came out around 78, 79, and they talked about space pirates, and it literally opens with a large ship that looks like Vader's ship at the beginning of New Hope. And it's like, this is a monster movie that they're just stealing at this point in time. So, like, it's watch for those things. But space battles does not mean that Star Wars holds the exclusive rights to space battles.
Hey, Josh?
Yes.
Unless there's any other questions, can you share a little bit about what's happening at Comic-Con in case anyone wants to...
Yeah, so the rules with Comic-Con, we're not supposed to announce panels until 2 weeks before the show. So now I will not post a podcast about this until 2 weeks before the show. but we have two panels at San Diego Comic-Con. And so the first is a mock trial to prove the actual innocence of Luke Cage. And it's from the Netflix series that ends with Luke in federal custody in New York for breaking out of prison in Atlanta. And so it's a writ of habeas corpus. It's attacking the underlying state action for him being imprisoned, which has all kinds of weird issues because he did escape from prison and he did not turn himself back in. So there's some great complex issues with that. And Judge Mitch Deben is presiding over it. He's a a magistrate judge in San Diego. And we have great lawyers who are going to have a lot of fun. A civil rights lawyer from San Jose, another one from Michigan who's participating. Representing the government, we have someone who is one of the deputy city attorneys for the city of San Diego and a U.S. attorney representing the government. And we have a U.S. Marshal playing Luke Cage. So, like, that's going to be wicked fun. And we've pulled from the comics and from the TV series to fill in the blanks for what we're doing. The other one is Judges on Star Wars. And so that is on Friday afternoon at Comic-Con. And we have California Supreme Court Justice Mariano Florentino Cuellar, who is a huge geek. When he agreed to be on this panel, he actually sent a list of topics of things he wanted to talk about, including the administrative and criminal law aspects of the Empire and the Republic. So he actually spent a lot of time thinking about this in advance. We have Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals Circuit Judge John B. Owens, who's also come up with some great topics like Chewbacca and Stolen Valor, because Chewie didn't get a medal at the end of the original Star Wars movie, and that was him. We have California Judge Kara Najera and Deben, who will debate whether or not the dark side is a addiction or lifestyle choice for Kylo Ren. And who am I forgetting? Magistrate Judge Stacey Beckerman from Oregon is on the panel, and former Magistrate Judge Paul Graywall, who's now Deputy General Counsel of Litigation at Facebook. So we have a lot of heavy hitters on that one, and being on Friday afternoon, it should be wicked fun. This is our third time going, and people love this stuff. I'm curious to see how we'll do, because the first year we did a Tatooine Law, and it was Graywall, my partner, and myself. It was Thursday night at 7 o'clock. 300 people showed up. There was a line out the door. Not everyone could get in, and the age range was from 5 to 70, and the questions we had, you know, included a kid who was like 6 or 7 who asked whether or not there'd be manufacturer liability for droids that kill people in the same way that you would sue the tobacco companies or gun manufacturers. And this was a 7-year-old, and we looked at him and was like, that's a really sophisticated question. And Judge Graywall answered it because we wanted the little guy to go home and being able to say that a federal judge answered his question that was really sophisticated. Last year we had 400 some people show up to hear about Star Trek with a line out the door of another 200. So people don't just love geek properties, they love the law because it's a foil for them to understand. And so you could, during the Q&A, people were actually doing IRAC. You could see the thought process as they were just, you know, thinking about whether it was right for Anakin to kill Count Dooku because he was too dangerous to live. And I said, well, technically he had been disarmed, and broke down why it was wrong to just kill him. And you could literally see the thought process. So when I think geek issues in the law, it really does highlight why we have faith in our society, because people do love the law and they want to understand it. So with that, yeah, that's what we'll be doing in July. So,
what are the exact dates?
So, preview night's July 19th. Thursday the 20th is when it begins, and it ends that Sunday on the 23rd. And so we're Thursday and Friday. I won't say more because they could change times, that sort of thing. My brother has a panel on Saturday, and it should be a good show. So with that, thank you so much for having me again. Always fun to come down here.